out of the silent planet continued. "More than 10 days' journey to the west," said Snorra. "The Harandra sinks down, not into a Handramit, but into a broad place, an open place, spreading every way. 5 days' journey from the north to the south of it, 10 days' journey from the east to the west. The forests are of other colors there than here. They are blue and green. It is very deep there. It goes to the roots of the world. The best things that can be dug out of the earth are there. The Pfiffeltriggi live there. They delight in digging. What they dig, they soften with fire and make things of it. They are little people, smaller than you, long in the snout, pale, busy. They have long limbs in front. No Snahu can match them in making and shaping things as none can match us in singing. But let a man see." He turned and spoke to one of the younger Hrossa, and presently, passed from hand to hand, there came to him a little bowl. He held it close to the firelight and examined it. It was certainly of gold, and Ransom realized the meaning of Divine's interest in Malakandra. "Is there much of this thing?" he asked. "Yes," he was told. "It was washed down in most of the rivers, but the best and most was among the Pfiffeltriggi, and it was they who were skilled in it. Arbol Hru, they called it, sun's blood." He looked at the bowl again. It was covered with fine etching. He saw pictures of Hrossa and of smaller, almost frog-like animals, and then of Sorns. He pointed to the latter inquiringly. "Sereni," said the Hrossa, confirming his suspicions. "They live up almost in the Harandra, in the big caves." The frog-like animals, or taper-headed, frog-bodied animals, were Pfiffeltriggi. Ransom turned it over in his mind. On Malakandra, apparently, three distinct species had reached rationality, and none of them had yet exterminated the other two. It concerned him intensely to find out which was the real master. "Which of the Snahu rule?" he asked. "Oyasa rules," was the reply. "Is he Snahu?" This puzzled them a little. The Sereni, they thought, would be better at that kind of question. Perhaps Oyasa was Hanahu, but a very different Hanahu. He had no death and no young. "These Sereni know more than the Hrossa?" asked Ransom. This produced more a debate than an answer. What emerged finally was the Sereni or Sorns were perfectly helpless in a boat, and could not fish to save their lives, could hardly swim, could make no poetry, and even when Hrossa had made it for them, could understand only the inferior sorts. But they were admittedly good at finding out things about the stars, and understanding the darker utterances of Oyasa, and telling what happened in Malakandra long ago, longer ago than anyone could remember. Ah, the intelligentsia, thought Ransom. They must be the real rulers, however it is disguised. He tried to ask what would happen if the Sorns used their wisdom to make the Hrossa do things. This was as far as he could get in his halting Malakandrian. The question did not sound nearly so urgent in this form as it would have done if he had been able to say, used their scientific resources for the exploitation of their uncivilized neighbors. But he might have spared his pains. The mention of the Sorns' inadequate appreciation of poetry had diverted the whole conversation into literary channels. Of the heated and apparently technical discussion which followed, he understood not a syllable. Naturally, his conversations with the Hrossa did not all turn on Malakandra. He had to repay them with information about Earth. He was hampered in this both by the humiliating discoveries which he was constantly making of his own ignorance about his native planet, and partly by his determination to conceal some of the truth. He did not want to tell them too much of our human wars and industrialisms. He remembered how H.G. Wells's Cavour had met his end on the moon. Also, he felt shy. A sensation akin to that of physical nakedness came over him whenever they questioned him too closely about men, the Hmana, as they called them. Moreover, he was determined not to let them know that he had been brought here to be given to the Sorns, for he was becoming daily more certain that these were the dominant species. What he did tell them fired the imagination of the Hrossa. They all began making poems about the strange Handra, where the plants were hard like stone, and the earth weed green like rock, and the waters cold and salt, and Hmana lived out on top, on the Harandra. They were even more interested in what he had to tell them of the aquatic animal with snapping jaws, which he had fled from in their own world, and even in their own Hadramit. It was a Hanakra, they all agreed. They were intensely excited. There had not been a Hanakra in the valley for many years. The youth of the Hrossa got out their weapons, primitive harpoons with points of bone, and the very cubs began playing at Hanakra hunting in the shallows. Some of the mothers showed signs of anxiety and wanted the cubs to be kept out of the water, but in general the news of the Hanakra seemed to be immensely popular. Hyoi set off at once to do something to his boat, and Ransom accompanied him. He wished to make himself useful, and was already beginning to have some vague capacity with the primitive Hrossian tools. They walked together to Hyoi's creek, a stone's throw through the forest. On the way, where the path was single and Ransom was following Hyoi, they passed a little she-horse, not much more than a cub. She spoke as they passed, but not to them. Her eyes were on a spot about 5 yards away. "Who do you speak to, Freaky?" said Ransom. "To the Eldil." "Where? Did you not see him?"
"I saw nothing."
"There, there!" she cried suddenly. "Ah, he is gone. Did you not see him?"
"I saw no one."
"Hyoi," said the cub, "the man cannot see the Eldil." But Hyoi, continuing steadily on his way, was already out of earshot, and had apparently noticed nothing. Ransom concluded that Hariki was pretending, like the young of his own species. In a few moments he rejoined his companion. Chapter 12. They worked hard at Hyoi's boat till noon, and then spread themselves on the weed close to the warmth of the creek, and began their midday meal. The warlike nature of their preparations suggested many questions to Ransom. He knew no word for war, but he managed to make Hyoi understand what he wanted to know. Did Serenny and Hrossa and Pfiffeltriggy ever go out like this, with weapons, against each other?
"What for?" asked Hyoi.
It was difficult to explain. "If both wanted one thing and neither would give it," said Ransom, "would the other at last come with force? Would they say, 'Give it or we kill you'?"
"What sort of thing?"
"Well, food, perhaps." "If the Knahu wanted food, why should we not give it to them? We often do." "But how if we had not enough for ourselves?"
"But Maleldil will not stop the plants growing."
"Hyoi, if you had more and more young, would Maleldil broaden the Hadramit and make enough plants for them all?"
"The Serenny know that sort of thing. But why should we have more young?"
Ransom found this difficult. At last he said, "Is the begetting of young not a pleasure among the Hrossa?"
"A very great one, man.
This is what we call love."
"If a thing is a pleasure, a man wants it again. He might want the pleasure more often than the number of young that could be fed."
It took Hyoi a long time to get the point.
"You mean," he said slowly, "that he might do it not only in 1 or 2 years of his life, but again?"
"Yes."
"But why? Would he want his dinner all day, or want to sleep after he had slept?"
"I do not understand."
"But a dinner comes every day. This love, you say, comes only once while the horse lives."
"But it takes his whole life. When he is young, he has to look for his mate. And then he has to court her. Then he begets young. Then he rears them. Then he remembers all this and boils it inside him and makes it into poems and wisdom."
"But the pleasure he must be content only to remember."
"That is like saying, 'My food I must be content only to eat.'"
"I do not understand."
"A pleasure is full grown only when it is remembered."
"You are speaking, man, as if the pleasure were one thing and the memory another. It is all one thing. The Serenny could say it better than I say it now. Not better than I could say it in a poem. What you call remembering is the last part of the pleasure, as the kra is the last part of a poem. When you and I met, the meeting was over very shortly. It was nothing. Now it is growing something as we remember it. But still we know very little about it. What it will be when I remember it as I lie down to die, what it makes in me all my days till then, that is the real meeting. The other is only the beginning of it. You say you have poets in your world. Do they not teach you this?"
"Perhaps some of them do," said Ransom. "But even in a poem does a cross never long to hear one splendid line over again?"
Hyoi's reply unfortunately turned on one of those points in their language which Ransom had not mastered. There were two verbs which both, as far as he could see, meant to long or yearn. But the Hrossa drew a sharp distinction, even an opposition between them. Hjoy seemed to him merely to be saying that everyone would long for it, one alone, but no one in his senses could long for it. Thrumpheline. And indeed, he continued, the poem is a good example, for the most splendid line becomes fully splendid only by means of all the lines after it. If you went back to it, you would find it less splendid than you thought. You would kill it. I mean in a good poem. But in a bent poem, Hjoy? A bent poem is not listened to, Herman. And how of love in a bent life? How could the life of Achnahu be bent? Did you say, Hjoy, that there are no bent Hrossa? Hjoy reflected. I have heard, he said at last, of something like what you mean. It is said that sometimes here and there a cub at a certain age gets strange twists in him. I have heard of one that wanted to eat earth. There might perhaps be somewhere a Hross, likewise, that wanted to have the years of love prolonged. I have not heard of it, but it might be. I have heard of something stranger. There is a poem about a Hross who lived long ago in another Hadramit, who saw things all made two suns in the sky, two heads on a neck. And last of all, they say that he fell into such a frenzy that he desired two mates. I do not ask you to believe it, but that is the story, that he loved two Hresni. Ranson pondered this. Here, unless Hjoy was deceiving him, was a species naturally continent, naturally monogamous. And yet, was it so strange? Some animals, he knew, had regular breeding seasons, and if nature could perform the miracle of turning the sexual impulse outward at all, why could she not go further and fix it, not morally, but instinctively, to a single object? He even remembered dimly having heard that some terrestrial animals, some of the lower animals, were naturally monogamous. Among the Hrossa, anyway, it was obvious that unlimited breeding and promiscuity were as rare as the rarest perversions. At last it dawned upon him that it was not they, but his own species, that were the puzzle. That the Hrossa should have such instincts was mildly surprising. But how came it that the instincts of the Hrossa so closely resembled the unattained ideals of that far-divided species, man, whose instincts were so deplorably different? What was the history of man? But Hjoy was speaking again. Undoubtedly, he said, Maleldil made us so. How could there ever be enough to eat if everyone had 20 young? And how could we endure to live and let time pass if we were always crying for one day or one year to come back? If we did not know that every day in a life fills the whole life with expectation and memory, and that these are that day. All the same, said Ranson, unconsciously nettled on behalf of his own world, Maleldil has let in the Hanakra. Oh, but that is so different. I long to kill this Hanakra, as he also longs to kill me. I hope that my ship will be the first, and I the first in my ship with my straight spear when the black jaws snap. And if he kills me, my people will mourn, and my brothers will desire still more to kill him. But they will not wish that there were no Hanaraki, nor do I. How can I make you understand when you do not understand the poets? The Hanakra is our enemy, but he is also our beloved. We feel in our hearts his joy as he looks down from the mountain of water in the north where he was born. We leap with him when he jumps the falls. And when winter comes, and the lake smokes higher than our heads, it is with his eyes that we see it, and know that his roaming time has come. We hang images of him in our houses, and the sign of all the Hrossa is a Hanakra. In him the spirit of the valley lives, and our young play at being Hanaraki as soon as they can splash in the shallows. And then he kills them? Not often, then. The Hrossa would be bent Hrossa if they let him get so near. Long before he had come down so far, we should have sought him out. No, Haman, it is not a few deaths roving the world around him that make Achnahu miserable. It is a bent Achnahu that would blacken the world. And I say also this. I do not think the forest would be so bright, nor the water so warm, nor love so sweet, if there were no danger in the lakes. I will tell you a day in my life that has shaped me. Such a day as comes only once, like love, or serving Oyasa in Meldalon. Then I was young, not much more than a cub, when I went far, far up the Handramit to the land where stars shine at midday and even water is cold. A great waterfall I climbed. I stood on the shore of Balki, the pool, which is the place of most awe in all worlds. The walls of it go up for ever and ever, and huge and holy images are cut in them, the work of old times. There is the fall called the Mountain of Water. Because I have stood there alone, Meleldil and I, for even Oyasa sent me no word, my heart has been higher, my song deeper, all my days. But do you think it would have been so unless I had known that in Balki, Hanariki dwelled? There I drank life, because death was in the pool. That was the best of drinks, save one. What one? Asked Ransom. Death itself, in the day I drink it and go to Meleldil. Shortly after that they rose and resumed their work. The sun was declining as they came back through the wood. It occurred to Ransom to ask Hjoy a question. Hjoy, he said, it comes into my head that when I first saw you, and before you saw me, you were already speaking. That was how I knew that you were Hnau, for otherwise I should have thought you a beast and run away. But who are you speaking to? To an Eldil. What is that? I saw no one. Are there no Eldilla in your world, man? That must be strange. But what are they? They come from Oyasa. They are, I suppose, a kind of Snahu. As we came out today, I passed a child who said she was talking to an Eldil, but I could see nothing. One can see by looking at your eyes, man, that they are different from ours. But Eldilla are hard to see. They are not like us. Light goes through them. You must be looking in the right place and the right time. And that is not likely to come about unless the Eldil wishes to be seen. Sometimes you can mistake them for a sunbeam, or even a moving of the leaves. But when you look again, you see that it was an Eldil, and that it is gone. But whether your eyes can ever see them, I do not know. The Serenity would know that. Chapter 13. The whole village was astir next morning before the sunlight, already visible on the Harandra, had penetrated the forest. By the light of the cooking fires, Ransom saw an incessant activity of Hrossa. The females were pouring out steaming food from clumsy pots. Hnoha was directing the transportation of piles of spears to the boats. Hjoy, in the midst of a group of the most experienced hunters, was talking too rapidly and too technically for Ransom to follow. Parties were arriving from the neighboring villages, and the cubs, squealing with excitement, were running hither and thither among their elders. He found that his own share in the hunt had been taken for granted. He was to be in Hjoy's boat with Hjoy and Hwin. The two Hrossa would take it in turns to paddle, while Ransom and the disengaged Hross would be in the bows. He understood the Hrossa well enough now to know that they were making him the noblest offer in their power, and that Hjoy and Hwin were each tormented by the fear lest he should be paddling when the Hanakra appeared. A short time ago, in England, nothing would have seemed more impossible to Ransom than to accept the post of honor and danger in an attack upon an unknown but certainly deadly aquatic monster. Even more recently, when he had first fled from the Sorns, or when he had lain pitying himself in the forest by night, it would hardly have been in his power to do what he was intending to do today. For his intention was clear. Whatever happened, he must show that the human species also were Hnau. He was only too well aware that such resolutions might look very different when the moment came, but he felt an unwonted assurance that somehow or other he would be able to go through with it. It was necessary, and the necessary was always possible. Perhaps, too, there was something in the air he now breathed, or in the society of the Hrossa, which had begun to work a change in him. The lake was just giving back the first rays of the sun when he found himself kneeling side by side with Hwin, as he had been told to, in the bows of Hjoy's ship, with a little pile of throwing spears between his knees and one in his right hand, stiffening his body against the motion as Hjoy paddled them out into their place. At least 100 boats were taking part in the hunt. They were in 3 parties. The central, and far the smallest, was to work its way up the current by which Hjoy and Ransom had descended after their first meeting. Longer ships than he had yet seen, 8 paddled ships, were used for this. The habit of the Nakra was to float down the current whenever he could. Meeting the ships, he would presumably dart out of it into the still water to left or right. Hence, while the central party slowly beat up the current, the lightships, paddling far faster, would cruise at will up and down either side of it to receive the quarry as soon as he broke what might be called his cover. In this game, numbers and intelligence were on the side of the Hrossa. The Hanakra had speed on his side and also invisibility, for he could swim underwater. He was nearly invulnerable, except through his open mouth. If the two hunters in the bows of the boat he made for muffed their shots, this was usually the last of them and of their boat. In the light skirmishing parties, there were two things a brave hunter could aim at. He could keep well back and close to the longships, where the Hanakra was most likely to break out, or he could get as far forward as possible in the hope of meeting the Hanakra, going at its full speed and yet untroubled by the hunt, and of inducing it, by a well-aimed spear, to leave the current then and there. One could thus anticipate the beaters and kill the beast, if that was how the matter ended, on one's own. This was the desire of Hjoy and Wim, and almost, so strongly they infected him, of Ransom. Hence, hardly had the heavy craft of the beaters begun their slow progress up current amid a wall of foam, when he found his own ship speeding northward as fast as Hjoy could drive her, already passing boat after boat and making for the freest water. The speed was exhilarating. In the cold morning, the warmth of the blue expanse they were clearing was not unpleasant. Behind them arose, re-echoed from the remote rock pinnacles on either side of the valley, the bell-like, deep-mouthed voices of more than 200 Hrossa, more musical than a cry of hounds, but closely akin to it in quality as in purport. Something long sleeping in the blood awoke in Ransom. It did not seem impossible at this moment that even he might be the Hanakra slayer, that the fame of Man Nakrapunt might be handed down to posterity in this world that knew no other man. But he had had such dreams before, and knew how they ended. Imposing humility on the newly risen riot of his feelings, he turned his eyes to the troubled water of the current which they were skirting, without entering, and watching intently. For a long time nothing happened. He became conscious of the stiffness of his attitude, and deliberately relaxed his muscles. Presently, Wynn reluctantly went aft to paddle, and Hjoy came forward to take his place. Almost as soon as the change had been effected, Hjoy spoke softly to him, and said, without taking his eyes off the current, "There is an Eldil coming to us over the water." Ransom could see nothing, or nothing that he could distinguish from imagination and the dance of sunlight on the lake. A moment later, Hjoy spoke again, but not to him. "What is it, Skyborn?" What happened next was the most uncanny experience Ransom had yet had on Malacandra. He heard the voice. It seemed to come out of the air, about a yard above his head, and it was almost an octave higher than the Hrossa's, higher even than his own. He realized that a very little difference in his ear would have made the Eldil as inaudible to him as it was invisible. "It is the man with you, Hjoy," said the voice. "He ought not to be there. He ought to be going to Oyarsa. Bent Hnau of his own kind from Thulkandra are following him. He should go to Oyarsa. If they find him anywhere else, there will be evil." "He hears you, Skyborn," said Hjoy. "And have you no message for my wife? You know what she wishes to be told." "I have a message for Hleri," said the Eldil, "but you will not be able to take it. I will go to her now myself. All that is well. Only let the man go to Oyarsa." There was a moment's silence. "He is gone," said Wynn, "and we have lost our share in the hunt." "Yes," said Hjoy with a sigh. "We must put Man ashore and teach him the way to Meldilorn." Ransom was not so sure of his courage, but that one part of him felt an instant relief at the idea of any diversion from their present business. But the other part of him urged him to hold on to his newfound manhood. Now or never, with such companions or with none, he must leave a deed on his memory instead of one more broken dream. It was in obedience to something like conscience that he exclaimed, "No, no, there is time for that after the hunt. We must kill the Hanakra first." "Once an Eldil has spoken," began Hjoy, when suddenly Wynn gave a great cry, a bark, Ransom would have called it 3 weeks ago, and pointed. There, not a furlong away, was the torpedo-like track of foam. And now, visible through the wall of the foam, they caught the metallic glint of the monster's sides. Quinn was paddling furiously. Hyoy threw and missed. As his first spear smote the water, his second was already in the air. This time it must have touched the Hanakra. He wheeled right out of the current. Ransom saw the great black pit of his mouth open twice, and twice shut with its snap of shark-like teeth. He himself had thrown now, hurriedly, excitedly, with unpracticed hand. "Back!" shouted Hyoy to Wynne, who was already backing water with every pound of his vast strength. Then all became confused. He heard Wynne shout, "Sure!" There came a shock that flung him forward almost into the Hanakra's jaws, and he found himself at the same moment up to his waist in water. It was at him the teeth were snapping. Then as he flung shaft after shaft into the great cavern of the gaping brute, he saw Hyoy perched incredibly on its back, on its nose, bending forward and hurling from there. Almost at once the cross was dislodged and fell with a wide splash nearly 10 yards away. But the Hanakra was killed. It was wallowing on its side, bubbling out its black life. The water around him was dark and stank. When he recollected himself, they were all on shore, wet, steaming, trembling with exertion, and embracing one another. This story is continued on cassette number 4, side 1.
Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis, continuing on cassette number 4, side 1. When he recollected himself, they were all on shore, wet, steaming, trembling with exertion, and embracing one another. It did not now seem strange to him to be clasped to a beast of wet fur. The breath of the Hrossa, which, though sweet, was not human breath, did not offend him. He was one with them. That difficulty which they, accustomed to more than one rational species, had perhaps never felt, was now overcome. They were all Hanahu. They had stood shoulder to shoulder in the face of an enemy, and the shapes of their heads no longer mattered. And he, even Ransom, had come through it and not been disgraced. He had grown up. They were on a little promontory free of forest, on which they had run aground in the confusion of the fight. The wreckage of the boat and the corpse of the monster lay confused together in the water beside them. No sound from the rest of the hunting party was audible. They had been almost a mile ahead when they met the Hanakra. All three sat down to recover their breath. "So," said Hyoy, "we are Hanakra Punti. This is what I have wanted all my life." At that moment, Ransom was deafened by a loud sound, a perfectly familiar sound, which was the last thing he expected to hear. It was a terrestrial, human, and civilized sound. It was even European. It was the crack of an English rifle, and Hyoy, at his feet, was struggling to rise, and gasping. There was blood on the white weed where he struggled. Ransom dropped on his knees beside him. The huge body of the Hross was too heavy for him to turn round. Wynne helped him. "Hyoy, can you hear me?" said Ransom, with his face close to the round, seal-like head. "Hyoy, it is through me that this has happened. It is the other Hamana who have hit you, the bent two that brought me to Malacandra. They can throw death at a distance with the thing they have made. I should have told you. We are all a bent race. We have come here to bring evil on Malacandra. We are only half Hanahu. Hyoy." His speech died away into the inarticulate. He did not know the words for forgive, or shame, or fault. Hardly the word for sorry. He could only stare into Hyoy's distorted face in speechless guilt. But the horse seemed to understand. It was trying to say something, and Ransom laid his ear close to the working mouth. Hyoy's dulling eyes were fixed on his own, but the expression of a horse was not even now perfectly intelligible to him. "Na, ma," it muttered. And then, at last, "Man, Hanakra Punt." Then there came a contortion of the whole body, a gush of blood and saliva from the mouth. His arms gave way under the sudden dead weight of the sagging head, and Hyoy's face became as alien and animal as it had seemed at their first meeting. The glazed eyes and the slowly stiffening, bedraggled fur were like those of any dead beast found in an earthly wood. Ransom resisted an infantile impulse to break out into imprecations on Weston and Devine. Instead, he raised his eyes to meet those of Wynne, who was crouching, Frossa, do not kneel, on the other side of the corpse. "I am in the hands of your people, Wynne," he said. "They must do as they will, but if they are wise, they will kill me, and certainly they will kill the other two."
"One does not kill a Nahu," said Wynne. "Only Oyasa does that. But these other, where are they?"
Ransom glanced around. It was open on the promontory, but thick wood came down to where it joined the mainland, perhaps 200 yards away.
"Somewhere in the wood," he said. "Lie down, Wynne, here where the ground is lowest. They may throw from their thing again."
He had some difficulty in making Wynne do as he suggested. When both were lying on dead ground, their feet almost in the water, the Frost spoke again.
"Why did they kill him?" he asked.
"They would not know he was Nahu," said Ransom. "I have told you that there is only one kind of Nahu in our world. They would think he was a beast. If they thought that, they would kill him for pleasure, or in fear, or," he hesitated, "because they were hungry. But I must tell you the truth, Wynne. They would kill even a Nahu, knowing it to be Nahu, if they thought its death would serve them."
There was a short silence.
"I am wondering," said Ransom, "if they saw me. It is for me they are looking. Perhaps if I went to them, they would be content and come no farther into your land. But why do they not come out of the wood to see what they have killed?"
"Our people are coming," said Wynne, turning his head. Ransom looked back and saw the lake black with boats. The main body of the hunt would be with them in a few minutes.
"They are afraid of the Hrossa," said Ransom. "That is why they do not come out of the wood. I will go to them, Wynne."
"No," said Wynne. "I have been thinking. All this has come from not obeying the Eldil. He said you were to go to Oyasa. You ought to have been already on the road. You must go now."
"But that will leave the bent Hamana here. They may do more harm."
"They will not set on the Hrossa. You have said they are afraid. It is more likely that we will come upon them. Never fear. They will not see us or hear us. We will take them to Oyasa. But you must go now, as the Eldil said."
"Your people will think I have run away because I am afraid to look in their faces after Hyoy's death."
"It is not a question of thinking, but of what an Eldil says. This is cub's talk. Now listen, and I will teach you the way."
The Hross explained to him that 5 days' journey to the south, the Handramit joined another Handramit, and 3 days up this other Handramit to west and north was Meldilorn and the seat of Oyarsa. But there was a shorter way, a mountain road, across the corner of the Harandra between the two canyons, which would bring him down to Meldilorn on the second day. He must go into the wood before them, and through it, till he came to the mountain wall of the Handramit. And he must work south along the roots of the mountains, till he came to a road cut up between them. Up this he must go, and somewhere beyond the tops of the mountains he would come to the Tower of Ogre. Ogre would help him. He could cut weed for his food before he left the forest and came into the rock country. Wynne realized that Ransom might meet the other two Hamana as soon as he entered the wood. "If they catch you," he said, "then it will be as you say. They will come no farther into our land. But it is better to be taken on your way to Oyasa than to stay here. And once you are on the way to him, I do not think he will let the Bent Ones stop you." Ransom was by no means convinced that this was the best plan, either for himself or for the Hrossa. But the stupor of humiliation in which he had lain ever since Hyoy fell forbade him to criticize. He was anxious only to do whatever they wanted him to do, to trouble them as little as was now possible, and above all, to get away. It was impossible to find out how Wynne felt, and Ransom sternly repressed an insistent, whining impulse to renewed protestations and regrets, self-accusations that might elicit some word of pardon. Hyoy, with his last breath, had called him Hanakra Slayer. That was forgiveness generous enough, and with that he must be content. As soon as he had mastered the details of his route, he bade farewell to Wynne and advanced alone towards the forest.
Chapter 14. Until he reached the wood, Ransom found it difficult to think of anything except the possibility of another rifle bullet from Weston or Devine. He thought that they probably still wanted him alive rather than dead, and this, combined with the knowledge that a Hross was watching him, enabled him to proceed with at least external composure. Even when he had entered the forest, he felt himself in considerable danger. The long, branchless stems made cover only if you were very far away from the enemy, and the enemy in this case might be very close. He became aware of a strong impulse to shout out to Weston and Devine and give himself up. It rationalized itself in the form that this would remove them from the district, as they would probably take him off to the Sorns and leave the Hrossa unmolested. But Ransom knew a little psychology and had heard of the hunted man's irrational instinct to give himself up. Indeed, he had felt it himself in dreams. It was some such trick, he thought, that his nerves were now playing him. In any case, he was determined henceforward to obey the Hrossa, or Eldilla. His efforts to rely on his own judgment in Malacandra had so far ended tragically enough. He made a strong resolution, defying in advance all changes of mood, that he would faithfully carry out the journey to Meldilorn if it could be done. This resolution seemed to him all the more certainly right, because he had the deepest misgivings about that journey. He understood that the Harandra, which he had to cross, was the home of the Sorns. In fact, he was walking of his own free will into the very trap that he had been trying to avoid ever since his arrival on Malacandra. Here, the first change of mood tried to raise its head. He thrust it down. And even if he got through the Sorns and reached Meldilorn, who or what might Oyasa be? Oyasa, Wynne had ominously observed, did not share the Hrossa's objection to shedding the blood of a Hnahu. And again, Oyasa ruled Sorns as well as Hrossa and Pfiffeltriggi. Perhaps he was simply the Arch-Sorn. And now came the second change of mood. Those old terrestrial fears of some alien, cold intelligence, superhuman in power, subhuman in cruelty, which had utterly faded from his mind among the Hrossa, rose clamoring for readmission. But he strode on. He was going to Meldilorn. It was not possible, he told himself, that the Hrossa should obey an evil or monstrous creature. And they had told him, or had they, he was not quite sure, that Oyasa was not a Sorn. Was Oyasa a god? Perhaps that very idol to whom the Sorns wanted to sacrifice him. But the Hrossa, though they said strange things about him, clearly denied that he was a god. There was one god, according to them, Maleldil, the young. Nor was it possible to imagine Hjoy or Nohra worshipping a blood-stained idol. Unless, of course, the Hrossa were, after all, under the thumb of the Sorns, superior to their masters in all the qualities that human beings value, but intellectually inferior to them and dependent on them. It would be a strange, but not an inconceivable world. Heroism and poetry at the bottom, cold scientific intellect above it, and overtopping all, some dark superstition which scientific intellect, helpless against the revenge of the emotional depths it had ignored, had neither will nor power to remove. A mumbo-jumbo. But Ransom pulled himself up. He knew too much now to talk that way. He and all his class would have called the Eldilla a superstition if they had been merely described to them, but now he had heard the voice himself. No, Oyasa was a real person, if he was a person at all. He had now been walking for about an hour, and it was nearly midday. No difficulty about his direction had yet occurred. He had merely to keep going uphill, and he was certain of coming out of the forests to the mountain wall sooner or later. Meanwhile, he felt remarkably well, though greatly chastened in mind. The silent, purple half-light of the woods spread all around him as it had spread on the first day he spent in Malacandra, but everything else was changed. He looked back on that time as on a nightmare, on his own mood at that time as a sort of sickness. Then all had been whimpering, unanalyzed, self-nourished, self-consuming dismay. Now, in the clear light of an accepted duty, he felt fear, indeed, but with it a sober sense of confidence in himself and in the world, and even an element of pleasure. It was the difference between a landsman in a sinking ship and a horseman on a bolting horse. Either may be killed, but the horseman is an agent as well as a patient. About an hour after noon, he suddenly came out of the wood into bright sunshine. He was only 20 yards from the almost perpendicular bases of the mountain spires, too close to them to see their tops. A sort of valley ran up in the re-entrant between two of them at the place where he had emerged, an unclimbable valley consisting of a single concave sweep of stone, which in its lower parts ascended steeply as the roof of a house, and farther up seemed almost vertical. At the top it even looked as if it hung over a bit, like a tidal wave of stone at the very moment of breaking. But this, he thought, might be an illusion. He wondered what the Hrosser's idea of a road might be. He began to work his way southward along the narrow, broken ground between wood and mountain. Great spurs of the mountains had to be crossed every few moments, and even in that lightweight world it was intensely tiring. After about half an hour he came to a stream. Here he went a few paces into the forest, cut himself an ample supply of the ground weed, and sat down beside the water's edge for lunch. When he had finished, he filled his pockets with what he had not eaten, and proceeded. He began soon to be anxious about his road, for if he could make the top at all, he could do it only by daylight, and the middle of the afternoon was approaching. But his fears were unnecessary. When it came, it was unmistakable. An open way through the wood appeared on the left. He must be somewhere behind the Hross village now. And on the right, he saw the road. A single ledge, or in places, a trench, cut sidewise and upwards across the sweep of such a valley as he had seen before. It took his breath away. The insanely steep, hideously narrow staircase without steps, leading up and up from where he stood to where it was an almost invisible thread on the pale green surface of the rock. But there was no time to stand and look at it. He was a poor judge of heights, but he had no doubt that the top of the road was removed from him by a more than alpine distance. It would take him at least till sundown to reach it. Instantly he began the ascent. Such a journey would have been impossible on earth. The first quarter of an hour would have reduced a man of Ransom's build and age to exhaustion. Here he was at first delighted with the ease of his movement, and then staggered by the gradient and length of the climb, which, even under Malachandrian conditions, soon bowed his back and gave him an aching chest and trembling knees. But this was not the worst. He heard already a singing in his ears, and noticed that despite his labor there was no sweat on his forehead. The cold, increasing at every step, seemed to sap his vitality worse than any heat could have done. Already his lips were cracked. His breath, as he panted, showed like a cloud. His fingers were numb. He was cutting his way up into a silent, arctic world, and had already passed from an English to a Lapland winter. It frightened him, and he decided that he must rest here or not at all. 100 paces more, and if he sat down, he would sit forever. He squatted on the road for a few minutes, slapping his body with his arms. The landscape was terrifying. Already the Hadramit, which had made his world for so many weeks, was only a thin purple cleft sunk amidst the boundless level desolation of the Harandra, which now, on the farthest side, showed clearly between and above the mountain peaks. But long before he was rested, he knew that he must go on or die. The world grew stranger. Among the Hrossa he had almost lost the feeling of being on a strange planet. Here it returned upon him with a desolating force. It was no longer the world, scarcely even a world. It was a planet, a star, a waste place in the universe, millions of miles from the world of men. It was impossible to recall what he had felt about Hjoy, or Hwin, or the Eldila, or Oyarsa. It seemed fantastic to have thought he had duties to such hobgoblins, if they were not hallucinations, met in the wilds of space. He had nothing to do with them. He was a man. Why had Weston and Devine left him alone like this? But all the time, the old resolution, taken when he could still think, was driving him up the road. Often he forgot where he was going and why. The movement became a mechanical rhythm, from weariness to stillness, from stillness to unbearable cold, from cold to motion again. He noticed that the Hadramit, now an insignificant part of the landscape, was full of a sort of haze. He had never seen a fog while he was living there. Perhaps that was what the air of the Hadramit looked like from above. Certainly it was a different air from this. There was something more wrong with his lungs and heart than even the cold and the exertion accounted for. And though there was no snow, there was an extraordinary brightness. The light was increasing, sharpening and growing whiter, and the sky was a much darker blue than he had ever seen on Malacandra. Indeed, it was darker than blue. It was almost black, and the jagged spires of rock standing against it were like his mental picture of a lunar landscape. Some stars were visible. Suddenly he realized the meaning of these phenomena. There was very little air above him. He was near the end of it. The Malacandrian atmosphere lay chiefly in the Hadramits. The real surface of the planet was naked, or thinly clad. The stabbing sunlight and the black sky above him were that heaven out of which he had dropped into the Malacandrian world, already showing through the last thin veil of air. If the top were more than 100 feet away, it would be where no man could breathe at all. He wondered whether the Hrossa had different lungs and had sent him by a road that meant death for man. But even while he thought of this, he took note that those jagged peaks blazing in sunlight against an almost black sky were level with him. He was no longer ascending, and on his right by a smooth ascending swell of stone that ran up to the true Harandra. And where he was, he could still breathe, though gasping, dizzy and in pain. The blaze in his eyes was worse. The sun was setting. The Hrossa must have foreseen this. They could not live any more than he on the Harandra by night. Still staggering forward, he looked about him for any sign of Augre's tower, whatever Augre might be. Doubtless he exaggerated the time during which he thus wandered and watched the shadows from the rocks lengthening towards him. It cannot really have been long before he saw a light ahead, a light which showed how dark the surrounding landscape had become. He tried to run, but his body would not respond. Stumbling in haste and weakness, he made for the light. Thought he had reached it and found that it was far farther than he had supposed. Almost despaired, staggered on again, and came at last to what seemed a cavern mouth. The light within was an unsteady one, and a delicious wave of warmth smote on his face. It was firelight. He came into the mouth of the cave, and then, unsteadily, round the fire into the interior, and stood still blinking in the light. When at last he could see, he discerned a smooth chamber of green rock, very lofty. There were two things in it. One of them, dancing on the wall and roof, was the huge, angular shadow of a Sorn. The other, crouching beneath it, was the Sorn himself. Chapter 15.
"Come in, small one," boomed the Sorn. "Come in and let me look at you."
Now that he stood face to face with the spectre that had haunted him ever since he had set foot on Malacandra, Ransom felt a surprising indifference. He had no idea what might be coming next, but he was determined to carry out his program, and in the meantime the warmth and more breathable air were a heaven in themselves. He came in, well in past the fire, and answered the Sorn. His own voice sounded to him a shrill treble. "The Hrossa have sent me to look for Oyarsa," he said. The Sorn peered at him.
"You are not from this world," it said suddenly.
"No," replied Ransom, and sat down. He was too tired to explain.
"I think you are from Pulcandra, small one," said the Sorn.
"Why?" said Ransom.
"You are small and thick, and that is how the animals ought to be made in a heavier world. You cannot come from Glundandra, for it is so heavy that if any animals could live there, they would be flat like plates. Even you, small one, would break if you stood up on that world. I do not think you are from Paralandra, for it must be very hot. If any came from there, they would not live when they arrived here. So I conclude you are from Pulcandra."
"The world I come from is called Earth by those who live there," said Ransom. "And it is much warmer than this. Before I came into your cave, I was nearly dead with cold and thin air." The Sorn made a sudden movement with one of its long forelimbs. Ransom stiffened, though he did not allow himself to retreat, for the creature might be going to grab him. In fact, its intentions were kindly. Stretching back into the cave, it took from the wall what looked like a cup. Then Ransom saw that it was attached to a length of flexible tube. The Sorn put it into his hands.
"Smell on this," it said. "The Hrossa also need it when they pass this way."
Ransom inhaled and was instantly refreshed. His painful shortness of breath was eased, and the tension of chest and temples was relaxed. The Sorn and the lighted cavern, hitherto vague and dreamlike to his eyes, took on a new reality. "Oxygen?" he asked, but naturally the English word meant nothing to the Sorn. "Are you called Ogrey?" he asked.
"Yes," said the Sorn.
"What are you called?"
"The animal I am is called Man, and therefore the Hrossa call me Haman, but my own name is Ransom."
"Man, Ransom," said the Sorn.
He noticed that it spoke differently from the Hrossa, without any suggestion of their persistent initial H. It was sitting on its long, wedge-shaped buttocks, with its feet drawn close up to it. A man in the same posture would have rested his chin on his knees, but the Sorn's legs were too long for that. Its knees rose high above its shoulders on each side of its head, grotesquely suggestive of huge ears, and the head, down between them, rested its chin on the protruding breast. The creature seemed to have either a double chin or a beard. Ransom could not make out which in the firelight. It was mainly white or cream in color, and seemed to be clothed down to the ankles in some soft substance that reflected the light. On the long, fragile shanks, where the creature was closest to him, he saw that this was some natural kind of coat. It was not like fur, but more like feathers. In fact, it was almost exactly like feathers. The whole animal, seen at close quarters, was less terrifying than he had expected, and even a little smaller. The face, it was true, took a good deal of getting used to. It was too long, too solemn, and too colorless, and it was much more unpleasantly like a human face than any inhuman creature's face ought to be. Its eyes, like those of all very large creatures, seemed too small for it. But it was more grotesque than horrible. A new conception of the Sorns began to arise in his mind. The ideas of giant and ghost receded behind those of goblin and gawk.
"Perhaps you are hungry, small one," it said.
Ransom was. The Sorn rose with strange, spidery movements and began going to and fro about the cave, attended by its thin goblin shadow. It brought him the usual vegetable foods of Malacandra and strong drink, with the very welcome addition of a smooth brown substance which revealed itself to nose, eye, and palate, in defiance of all probability, as cheese. Ransom asked what it was. The Sorn began to explain painfully how the female of some animals secreted a fluid for the nourishment of its young, and would have gone on to describe the whole process of milking and cheese-making if Ransom had not interrupted it.
"Yes, yes," he said, "we do the same on Earth. What is the beast you use?"
"It is a yellow beast with a long neck. It feeds on the forests that grow in the Handramit. The young ones of our people who are not yet fit for much else drive the beasts down there in the mornings and follow them while they feed. Then before night they drive them back and put them in the caves."
For a moment Ransom found something reassuring in the thought that the Sorns were shepherds. Then he remembered that the Cyclops in Homer plied the same trade.
"I think I have seen one of your people at this very work," he said. "But the Hrossa, they let you tear up their forests?"
"Why should they not?"
"Do you rule the Hrossa?"
"Oyarsa rules them."
"And who rules you?"
"Oyarsa."
"But you know more than the Hrossa."
"The Hrossa know nothing except about poems and fish and making things grow out of the ground."
"And Oyarsa, is he a Sorn?"
"No, no, small one. I have told you he rules all Nahu."
So he pronounced Nahu.
"And everything in Malacandra."
"I do not understand this Oyarsa," said Ransom. "Tell me more."
"Oyarsa does not die," said the Sorn. "And he does not breed. He is the one of his kind who was put into Malacandra to rule it when Malacandra was made. His body is not like ours, nor yours. It is hard to see, and the light goes through it."
"Like an Eldil?"
"Yes, he is the greatest of Eldila who ever come to Ahandra."
"What are these Eldila?"
"Do you tell me, small one, that there are no Eldila in your world?"
The story is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.
Out of the Silent Planet continued.
Do you tell me, small one, that there are no Eldila in your world?
Not that I know of. But what are Eldila, and why can I not see them? Have they no bodies?
Of course they have bodies. There are a great many bodies you cannot see. Every animal's eyes see some things, but not others. Do you not know of many kinds of body in Thulcandra?
Ransom tried to give the Sorn some idea of the terrestrial terminology of solids, liquids, and gases. It listened with great attention.
That is not the way to say it, it replied. Body is movement. If it is at one speed, you smell something. If at another, you hear a sound. If at another, you see a sight. If at another, you neither see nor hear nor smell, nor know the body in any way. But mark this, small one, that the two ends meet.
How do you mean?
If movement is faster, then that which moves is more nearly in two places at once.
That is true.
But if the movement were faster still, it is difficult, for you do not know many words. You see that if you made it faster and faster, in the end, the moving thing would be in all places at once, small one.
I think I see that.
Well, then, that is the thing at the top of all bodies, so fast that it is at rest, so truly body that it has ceased being body at all. But we will not talk of that.
Start from where we are, small one. The swiftest thing that touches our senses is light.
We do not truly see light. We only see slower things lit by it, so that for us, light is on the edge. The last thing we know before things become too swift for us. But the body of an Eldil is a movement swift as light. You may say its body is made of light, but not of that which is light for the Eldil. His light is a swifter movement which for us is nothing at all. And what we call light is for him a thing like water, a visible thing, a thing he can touch and bathe in, even a dark thing when not illumined by the swifter. And what we call firm things, flesh and earth, seem to him thinner and harder to see than our light, and more like clouds, and nearly nothing. To us the Eldil is a thin, half-real body that can go through walls and rocks. To himself he goes through them, because he is solid and firm, and they are like cloud. And what is true light to him, and fills the heaven, so that he will plunge into the rays of the sun to refresh himself from it, is to us the black nothing in the sky at night. These things are not strange, small one, though they are beyond our senses. But it is strange that the Eldila never visit Thulcandra.
Of that I am not certain, said Ransom. It had dawned on him that the recurrent human tradition of bright, elusive people sometimes appearing on the earth, Albs, Devas, and the like, might, after all, have another explanation than the anthropologists had yet given. True, it would turn the universe rather oddly inside out, but his experiences in the spaceship had prepared him for some such operation. "Why does Oyarsa send for me?" he asked.
"Oyarsa has not told me," said the Sorn, "but doubtless he would want to see any stranger from another Handra."
"We have no Oyarsa in my world," said Ransom.
"That is another proof," said the Sorn, "that you come from Thulcandra, the Silent Planet."
"What has that to do with it?"
The Sorn seemed surprised. "It is not very likely, if you had an Oyarsa, that he would never speak to ours."
"Speak to yours? But how could he? It is millions of miles away."
"Oyarsa would not think of it like that."
"Do you mean that he ordinarily receives messages from other planets?"
"Once again, he would not say it that way.
Oyarsa would not say that he lives on Malakandra and that another Oyarsa lives on another Earth.
For him, Malakandra is only a place in the heavens. It is in the heavens that he and the others live. Of course they talk together."
Ransom's mind shied away from the problem. He was getting sleepy and thought he must be misunderstanding the Sorn. "I think I must sleep, Orgrey," he said, "and I do not know what you are saying. Perhaps, too, I do not come from what you call Thulcandra."
"We will both sleep presently," said the Sorn. But first I will show you Thulkandra." It rose, and Ransom followed it into the back of the cave. Here he found a little recess, and running up within it a winding stair. The steps, hewn for thorns, were too high for a man to climb with any comfort, but using hands and knees, he managed to hobble up. The thorn preceded him. Ransom did not understand the light, which seemed to come from some small round object which the creature held in its hand. They went up a long way, almost as if they were climbing up the inside of a hollow mountain. At last, breathless, he found himself in a dark but warm chamber of rock, and heard the thorn saying, "She is still well above the southern horizon." It directed his attention to something like a small window. Whatever it was, it did not appear to work like an earthly telescope, Ransom thought. Though an attempt made next day to explain the principles of the telescope to the thorn threw grave doubts on his own ability to discern the difference. He leaned forward with his elbows on the sill of the aperture and looked. He saw perfect blackness, and, floating in the center of it, seemingly an arm's length away, a bright disk about the size of a half crown. Most of its surface was featureless, shining silver. Towards the bottom markings appeared, and below them a white cap, just as he had seen the polar caps in astronomical photographs of Mars. He wondered for a moment if it was Mars he was looking at. Then, as his eyes took in the markings better, he recognized what they were: Northern Europe and a piece of North America. They were upside down, with the North Pole at the bottom of the picture, and this somehow shocked him. But it was the Earth he was seeing, even perhaps England, though the picture shook a little, and his eyes were quickly getting tired, and he could not be certain that he was not imagining it. It was all there in that little disk: London, Athens, Jerusalem, Shakespeare. There everyone had lived and everything had happened. And there, presumably, his pack was still lying on the porch of an empty house near Stirk. "Yes," he said dully to the thorn, "that is my world." It was the bleakest moment in all his travels. Chapter 16. Ransom awoke next morning with the vague feeling that a great weight had been taken off his mind. Then he remembered that he was the guest of a thorn, and that the creature he had been avoiding ever since he landed had turned out to be as amicable as the Hrossa, though he was far from feeling the same affection for it. Nothing then remained to be afraid of in Malakandra except Oyarsa. "The last fence," thought Ransom. Orgreave gave him food and drink. "And now," said Ransom, "how shall I find my way to Oyarsa?"
"I will carry you," said the thorn. "You are too small a one to make the journey yourself, and I will gladly go to Meldalorn. The Hrossa should not have sent you this way. They do not seem to know from looking at an animal what sort of lungs it has and what it can do. It is just like a Hross. If you died on the Harandra, they would have made a poem about the gallant Haman, and how the sky grew black and the cold stars shone, and he journeyed on and journeyed on, and they would have put in a fine speech for you to say as you were dying, and all this would seem to them just as good as if they had used a little forethought and saved your life by sending you the easier way round."
"I like the Hrossa," said Ransom a little stiffly, "and I think the way they talk about death is the right way."
"They are right not to fear it," read Soon. "But they do not seem to look at it reasonably as part of the very nature of our bodies, and therefore often avoidable at times when they would never see how to avoid it. For example, this has saved the life of many a Hross, but a Hross would not have thought of it." He showed Ransom a flask with a tube attached to it, and at the end of the tube a cup, obviously an apparatus for administering oxygen to oneself. "Smell on it as you have need, small one," said the thorn, "and close it up when you do not." Orgreave fastened the thing on his back and gave the tube over his shoulder into his hand. Ransom could not restrain a shudder at the touch of the thorn's hands upon his body. They were fan-shaped, seven-fingered, mere skin over bone like a bird's leg, and quite cold. To divert his mind from such reactions, he asked where the apparatus was made, for he had as yet seen nothing remotely like a factory or a laboratory. We thought it, said the Sorn, and the Pfiffeltriggy made it.
Why do they make them, said Ransom.
He was trying once more, with his insufficient vocabulary, to find out the political and economic framework of Malachandrian life. They like making things, said Orgreave. It is true they like best the making of things that are only good to look at and of no use. But sometimes when they are tired of that, they will make things for us, things we have thought, provided they are difficult enough. They have not patience to make easy things, however useful they would be. But let us begin our journey. You shall sit on my shoulder. The proposal was unexpected and alarming, but seeing that the Sorn had already crouched down, Ransom felt obliged to climb onto the plume-like surface of its shoulder, to seat himself beside the long, pale face, casting his right arm as far as it would go round the huge neck, and to compose himself as well as he could for his precarious mode of travel. The giant rose cautiously to a standing position, and he found himself looking down on the landscape from a height of about 18 feet. "All is well, small one?" it asked. "Very well," Ransom answered, and the journey began. Its gait was perhaps the least human thing about it. It lifted its feet very high and set them down very gently. Ransom was reminded alternately of a cat stalking, a strutting barn-door fowl, and a high-stepping carriage horse. But the movement was not really like that of any terrestrial animal. For the passenger, it was surprisingly comfortable. In a few minutes, he had lost all sense of what was dizzying or unnatural in his position. Instead, ludicrous and even tender associations came crowding into his mind. It was like riding an elephant at the zoo in boyhood, like riding on his father's back at a still earlier age. It was fun. They seemed to be doing between 6 and 7 miles an hour. The cold, though severe, was endurable, and, thanks to the oxygen, he had little difficulty with his breathing. The landscape which he saw from his high, swaying post of observation was a solemn one. The Handramit was nowhere to be seen. On each side of the shallow gully in which they were walking, a world of naked, faintly greenish rock, interrupted with wide patches of red, extended to the horizon. The heaven, darkest blue where the rock met it, was almost black at the zenith, and, looking in any direction where the sunlight did not blind him, he could see the stars. He learned from the Sorn that he was right in thinking they were near the limits of the breathable. Already on the mountain fringe that borders the Herandra and walls the Handramit, or in the narrow depression along which their road led them, the air is of Himalayan rarity, ill-breathing for a frost, and a few hundred feet higher, on the Herandra proper, the true surface of the planet, it admits no life. Hence the brightness through which they walked was almost that of heaven, celestial light hardly at all tempered with an atmospheric veil. The shadow of the Sorn, with Ransom's shadow on its shoulder, moved over the uneven rock unnaturally distinct, like the shadow of a tree before the headlights of a car, and the rock beyond the shadow hurt his eyes. The remote horizon seemed but an arm's length away. The fissures and molding of distant slopes were clear as the background of a primitive picture made before men learned perspective. He was on the very frontier of that heaven he had known in the spaceship, and rays that the air-enveloped worlds cannot taste were once more at work upon his body. He felt the old lift of the heart, the soaring solemnity, the sense, at once sober and ecstatic, of life and power offered in unmasked and unmeasured abundance. If there had been air enough in his lungs, he would have laughed aloud. And now, even in the immediate landscape, beauty was drawing near. Over the edge of the valley, as if it had frothed down from the true Herandra, came great curves of the rose-tinted cumular stuff which he had seen so often from a distance. Now, on a nearer view, they appeared hard as stone in substance, but puffed above and stalked beneath like vegetation. His original simile of giant cauliflower turned out to be surprisingly correct. Stone cauliflowers the size of cathedrals and the color of pale rose. He asked the Sorn what it was. "It is the old forests of Malachandra," said Orgre. "Once there was air on the Herandra, and it was warm. To this day, if you could get up there and live, you would see it all covered with the bones of ancient creatures. It was once full of life and noise.
It was then these forests grew, and in and out among their stalks went a people that have vanished from the world these many thousand years. They were covered not with fur, but with a coat like mine. They did not go in the water swimming, or on the ground walking. They glided on the air on broad, flat limbs which kept them up. It is said they were great singers, and in those days the red forests echoed with their music. Now the forests have become stone, and only Eldala can go among them. "We still have such creatures in our world," said Ransom. "We call them birds. Where was Oyasa when all this happened to the Herandra?"
"Where he is now."
"And he could not prevent it?"
"I do not know. But a world is not made to last forever, much less a race. That is not Maleldil's way."
As they proceeded, the petrified forests grew more numerous, and often, for half an hour at a time, the whole horizon of the lifeless, almost airless waste blushed like an English garden in summer. They passed many caves where, as Augrey told him, sorns lived. Sometimes a high cliff would be perforated with countless holes to the very top, and unidentifiable noises came hollowly from within. "Work was in progress," said the sorn, but of what kind it could not make him understand. Its vocabulary was very different from that of the Hrossa. Nowhere did he see anything like a village or city of sorns, who were apparently solitary, not social creatures. Once or twice a long pallid face would show from a cavern mouth and exchange a horn-like greeting with the travelers, but for the most part the long valley, the rock street of the silent people, was still and empty as the Herandra itself. Only towards afternoon, as they were about to descend into a dip of the road, they met three sorns together coming towards them down the opposite slope. They seemed to Ransom to be rather skating than walking. The lightness of their world and the perfect poise of their bodies allowed them to lean forward at right angles to the slope, and they came swiftly down like full-rigged ships before a fair wind. The grace of their movement, their lofty stature, and the softened glancing of the sunlight on their feathery sides effected a final transformation in Ransom's feelings toward their race. Ogres, he had called them, when they first met his eyes as he struggled in the grip of Weston and Divine. Titans, or angels, he now thought would have been a better word. Even the faces, it seemed to him, he had not then seen aright. He had thought them spectral when they were only august, and his first human reaction to their lengthened severity of line and profound stillness of expression now appeared to him not so much cowardly as vulgar. So might Parmenides or Confucius look to the eyes of a Cockney schoolboy. The great white creatures sailed towards Ransom and Augrey and dipped like trees and passed. In spite of the cold, which made him often dismount and take a spell on foot, he did not wish for the end of the journey. But Augrey had his own plans and halted for the night long before sundown at the home of an older sorn. Ransom saw well enough that he was brought there to be shown to a great scientist. The cave, or so to speak more correctly, the system of excavations, was large and many-chambered, and contained a multitude of things that he did not understand. He was specially interested in a collection of rolls, seemingly of skin, covered with characters, which were clearly books. But he gathered that books were few in Malacandra. "It is better to remember," said the sorns. When Ransom asked if valuable secrets might not thus be lost, they replied that Oyasa always remembered them and would bring them to light if he thought fit. "The Hrossa used to have many books of poetry," they added, "but now they have fewer. They say that the writing of books destroys poetry." Their host in these caverns was attended by a number of other sorns, who seemed to be in some way subordinate to him. Ransom thought at first that they were servants, but decided later they were pupils or assistants. The evening's conversation was not such as would interest a terrestrial reader, for the sorns had determined that Ransom should not ask but answer questions. Their questioning was very different from the rambling, imaginative inquiries of the Hrossa. They worked systematically from the geology of Earth to its present geography, and thence in turn to flora, fauna, human history, languages, politics, and arts. When they found that Ransom could tell them no more on a given subject, and this happened pretty soon in most of their inquiries,
they dropped it at once and went on to the next. Often they drew out of him indirectly much more knowledge than he consciously possessed, apparently working from a wide background of general science. A casual remark about trees, when Ransom was trying to explain the manufacture of paper, would fill up for them a gap in his sketchy answers to their botanical questions. His account of terrestrial navigation might illuminate mineralogy, and his description of the steam engine gave them a better knowledge of terrestrial air and water than Ransom had ever had. He had decided from the outset that he would be quite frank, for he now felt that it would be not Hanahu, and also that it would be unavailing to do otherwise. They were astonished at what he had to tell them of human history, of war, slavery, and prostitution. "It is because they have no Oyarsa," said one of the pupils. "It is because every one of them wants to be a little Oyarsa himself," said Augrey. "They cannot help it," said the old Sorn. "There must be rule, yet how can creatures rule themselves? Beasts must be ruled by Hanahu, and Hanahu by Eldila, and Eldila by Meleldil. These creatures have no Eldila. They are like one trying to lift himself by his own hair, or one trying to see over a whole country when he is on a level with it, like a female trying to beget young on herself." Two things about our world particularly stuck in their minds. One was the extraordinary degree to which problems of lifting and carrying things absorbed our energy. The other was the fact that we had only one kind of Hanahu. They thought this must have far-reaching effects in the narrowing of sympathies and even of thought. "Your thought must be at the mercy of your blood," said the old Sorn, "for you cannot compare it with thoughts that float on a different blood." It was a tiring and very disagreeable conversation for Ransom, but when at last he lay down to sleep, it was not of the human nakedness nor of his own ignorance that he was thinking. He thought only of the old forests of Malacandra, and of what it might mean to grow up seeing always, so few miles away, a land of color that could never be reached and had once been inhabited. Chapter 17. Early next day, Ransom again took his seat on Augrey's shoulder. For more than an hour, they traveled through the same bright wilderness. Far to the north, the sky was luminous with a cloud-like mass of dull red or ochre. It was very large and drove furiously westward about 10 miles above the waist. Ransom, who had yet seen no cloud in the Malacandrian sky, asked what it was. The Sorn told him it was sand, caught up from the great northern deserts by the winds of that terrible country. It was often thus carried, sometimes at a height of 17 miles, to fall again, perhaps in a handromit, as a choking and blinding dust storm. The sight of it moving with menace in the naked sky served to remind Ransom that they were indeed on the outside of Malacandra, no longer dwelling in a world, but crawling the surface of a strange planet. At last the cloud seemed to drop and burst far on the western horizon, where a glow, not unlike that of a conflagration, remained visible till a turn of the valley hid all that region from his view. The same turn opened a new prospect to his eyes. What lay before him looked at first strangely like an earthly landscape, a landscape of gray downland ridges rising and falling like waves of the sea. Far beyond, cliffs and spires of the familiar green rock rose against the dark blue sky. A moment later, he saw that what he had taken for downlands was but the ridged and furrowed surface of a blue-gray valley mist, a mist which would not appear a mist at all when they descended into the Handramit. And already, as their road began descending, it was less visible, and the many-colored pattern of the low country showed vaguely through it. The descent grew quickly steeper. Like the jagged teeth of a giant with very bad teeth, the topmost peaks of the mountain wall down which they must pass loomed up over the edge of their gully. The look of the sky and the quality of the light were infinitesimally changed. A moment later they stood on the edge of such a slope as by earthly standards would rather be called a precipice. Down and down this face, to where it vanished in a purple blush of vegetation, ran their road. Ransom refused absolutely to make the descent on Augrey's shoulder. the Sorn, though it did not fully understand his objection, stooped for him to dismount, and proceeded, with that same skating and forward-sloping motion, to go down before him. Ransom followed, using gladly but stiffly his numb legs. The beauty of this new Handramit, as it opened before him, took his breath away. It was wider than that in which he had hitherto lived, and right below him lay an almost circular lake, a sapphire 12 miles in diameter, set in a border of purple forest. Amidst the lake there rose like a low and gently sloping pyramid, or like a woman's breast, an island of pale red, smooth to the summit, and on the summit a grove of such trees as man had never seen. Their smooth columns had the gentle swell of the noblest beech trees. But these were taller than a cathedral spire on earth, and at their tops they broke rather into flower than foliage, into golden flower, bright as tulip, still as rock and huge as summer cloud. Flowers indeed they were, not trees, and far down among their roots he caught a pale hint of slab-like architecture. He knew before his guide told him that this was Meldelorn. He did not know what he had expected. The old dreams which he had brought from Earth of some more than American complexity of offices, or some engineer's paradise of vast machines, had indeed been long laid aside. But he had not looked for anything quite so classic, so virginal, as this bright grove, lying so still, so secret in its colored valley, soaring with inimitable grace so many hundred feet into the wintry sunlight. At every step of his descent, the comparative warmth of the valley came up to him more deliciously. He looked above, the sky was turning to a paler blue. He looked below, and sweet and faint, the thin fragrance of the giant blooms came up to him. Distant crags were growing less sharp in outline, and surfaces less bright. Depth, dimness, softness, and perspective were returning to the landscape. The lip or edge of rock from which they had started their descent was already far overhead. It seemed unlikely that they had really come from there. He was breathing freely. His toes, so long benumbed, could move delightfully inside his boots. He lifted the ear flaps of his cap and found his ears instantly filled with the sound of falling water. And now he was treading on soft groundweed over level earth, and the forest roof was above his head. They had conquered the Herandra, and were on the threshold of Meldelorn. A short walk brought them into a kind of forest ride, a broad avenue running straight as an arrow through the purple stems to where the vivid blue of the lake danced at the end of it. There they found a gong and hammer hung on a pillar of stone. These objects were all richly decorated, and the gong and hammer were of a greenish-blue metal, which Ransom did not recognize. Orgray struck the gong. This book is continued on cassette number 5, side 1. Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis, continuing on cassette number 5, side 1. Orgray struck the gong. An excitement was rising in Ransom's mind, which almost prevented him from examining as coolly as he wished the ornamentation of the stone. It was partly pictorial, partly pure decoration. What chiefly struck him was a certain balance of packed and empty surfaces. Pure line drawings, as bare as the prehistoric pictures of reindeer on earth, alternated with patches of design as close and intricate as Norse or Celtic jewelry. And then, as you looked at it, these empty and crowded areas turned out to be themselves arranged in larger designs. He was struck by the fact that the pictorial work was not confined to the emptier spaces. Quite often, large arabesques included as a subordinate detail intricate pictures. Elsewhere, the opposite plan had been followed, and this alternation, too, had a rhythmical or patterned element in it. He was just beginning to find out that the pictures, though stylized, were obviously intended to tell a story, when Augury interrupted him. A ship had put out from the island shore of Meldelorn. As it came towards them, Ransom's heart warmed to see that it was paddled by a Hross. The creature brought its boat up to the shore where they were waiting, stared at Ransom, and then looked inquiringly at Orgray. "You may well wonder at this Na'u, Frinha," said the Sorn, "for you have never seen anything like it. It is called Rensum, and has come through heaven from Thulkandra.
It is welcome, Ogre, said the Frost politely. Is it coming to Oyarsa?
He has sent for it.
And for you also, Ogre.
Oyarsa has not called me. If you will take Rensum over the water, I will go back to my tower.
The Frost indicated that Ransom should enter the boat. He attempted to express his thanks to the Sorn, and after a moment's consideration, unstrapped his wristwatch and offered it to him. It was the only thing he had which seemed a suitable present for a Sorn. He had no difficulty in making Ogre understand its purpose. But after examining it, the giant gave it back to him, a little reluctantly, and said,
This gift ought to be given to a Pififeltrig. It rejoices my heart, but they would make more of it. You are likely to meet some of the busy people in Meldelorn. Give it to them. As for its use, do your people not know, except by looking at this thing, how much of the day has worn?
I believe there are beasts that have a sort of knowledge of that, said Ransom, but our Hnahu have lost it. After this, his farewells to the Sorn were made, and he embarked. To be once more in a boat, and with a cross, to feel the warmth of water on his face, and to see a blue sky above him, was almost like coming home. He took off his cap and leaned back luxuriously in the bows, plying his escort with questions. He learned that the Hrossa were not specially concerned with the service of Oyarsa, as he had surmised from finding a Hross in charge of the ferry. All three species of Hnahu served him in their various capacities, and the ferry was naturally entrusted to those who understood boats. He learned that his own procedure on arriving in Meldelorn must be to go where he liked and do what he pleased until Oyarsa called for him. It might be an hour or several days before this happened. He would find huts near the landing place where he could sleep if necessary and where food would be given him. In return, he related as much as he could make intelligible of his own world and his journey from it. And he warned the Hross of the dangerous bent men who had brought him and who were still at large on Malacandra. As he did so, it occurred to him that he had not made this sufficiently clear to Ogre. But he consoled himself with the reflection that Weston and Devine seemed to have already some liaison with the Sorns, and that they would not be likely to molest things so large and so comparatively manlike. At any rate, not yet. About Devine's ultimate designs, he had no illusions. All he could do was to make a clean breast of them to Oyarsa. And now the ship touched land. Ransom rose while the Hross was making fast and looked about him. Close to the little harbor, which they had entered, and to the left, were low buildings of stone, the first he had seen in Malacandra, and fires were burning. There, the Hross told him, he could find food and shelter. For the rest, the island seemed desolate, and its smooth slopes empty up to the grove that crowned them, where again he saw stonework. But this appeared to be neither temple nor house in the human sense, but a broad avenue of monoliths, a much larger Stonehenge, stately, empty, and vanishing over the crest of the hill into the pale shadow of the flower trunks. All was solitude, but as he gazed upon it, he seemed to hear, against the background of morning silence, a faint, continual agitation of silvery sound, hardly a sound at all, if you attended to it, and yet impossible to ignore. "The island is all full of Eldilar," said the Frost in a hushed voice. He went ashore. As though half expecting some obstacle, he took a few hesitant paces forward and stopped, and then went on again in the same fashion. Though the groundweed was unusually soft and rich, and his feet made no noise upon it, he felt an impulse to walk on tiptoes. All his movements became gentle and sedate. The width of water about this island made the air warmer than any he had yet breathed in Malacandra. The climate was almost that of a warm, earthly day in late September, a day that is warm but with a hint of frost to come. A sense of awe which was increasing upon him deterred him from approaching the crown of the hill, the grove, and the avenue of standing stones. He ceased ascending about halfway up the hill and began walking to his right, keeping a constant distance from the shore. He said to himself that he was having a look at the island, but his feeling was rather that the island was having a look at him. This was greatly increased by a discovery he made after he had been walking for about an hour, and which he ever afterwards found great difficulty in describing. In the most abstract terms, it might be summed up by saying that the surface of the island was subject to tiny variations of light and shade, which no change in the sky accounted for. If the air had not been calm and the ground weed too short and firm to move in the wind, he would have said that a faint breeze was playing with it, and working such slight alterations in the shading as it does in a cornfield on the earth. Like the silvery noises in the air, these footsteps of light were shy of observation. Where he looked hardest, they were least to be seen. On the edges of his field of vision, they came crowding as though a complex arrangement of them were there in progress. To attend to any one of them was to make it invisible, and the minute brightness seemed often to have just left the spot where his eyes fell. He had no doubt that he was seeing, as much as he ever would see, the Eldala. The sensation it produced in him was curious. It was not exactly uncanny, not as if he were surrounded by ghosts. It was not even as if he were being spied upon. He had rather the sense of being looked at by things that had a right to look. His feeling was less than fear. It had in it something of embarrassment, something of shyness, something of submission, and it was profoundly uneasy. He felt tired, and thought that in this favored land it would be warm enough to rest out of doors. He sat down. The softness of the weed, the warmth and the sweet smell which pervaded the whole island, reminded him of earth and gardens in summer. He closed his eyes for a moment. Then he opened them again and noticed buildings below him, and over the lake he saw a boat approaching. Recognition suddenly came to him. That was the ferry, and these buildings were the guest house beside the harbor. He had walked all round the island. A certain disappointment succeeded this discovery. He was beginning to feel hungry. Perhaps it would be a good plan to go down and ask for some food. At any rate, it would pass the time. But he did not do so. When he rose and looked more closely at the guest house, he saw a considerable stir of creatures about it. And while he watched, he saw that a full load of passengers was landing from the ferry boat. In the lake he saw some moving objects which he did not at first identify, but which turned out to be sorns up to their middles in the water, and obviously wading to Meldalorn from the mainland. There were about 10 of them. For some reason or other, the island was receiving an influx of visitors. He no longer supposed that any harm would be done to him if he went down and mixed in the crowd, but he felt a reluctance to do so. The situation brought vividly back to his mind his experience as a new boy at school. New boys came a day early, hanging about and watching the arrival of the old hands. In the end, he decided not to go down. He cut and ate some of the ground weed and dozed a little. In the afternoon, when it grew colder, he resumed his walking. Other Hanau'u were roaming about the island by this time. He saw sorns, chiefly, but this was because their height made them conspicuous. There was hardly any noise. His reluctance to meet these fellow wanderers, who seemed to confine themselves to the coast of the island, drove him half-consciously upwards and inwards. He found himself at last on the fringes of the grove and looked straight up the monolithic avenue. He had intended, for no very clearly defined reason, not to enter it. But he fell to studying the stone nearest to him, which was richly sculptured on all its four sides, and after that curiosity led him on from stone to stone. The pictures were very puzzling. Side by side with representations of Sorns and Hrossa, and what he supposed to be Pififiltrigi, there occurred again and again an upright wavy figure, with only the suggestion of a face, and with wings. The wings were perfectly recognizable, and this puzzled him very much. Could it be that the traditions of Malacandrian art went back to that earlier geological and biological era when, as Augre had told him, there was life, including bird life, on the Harandra? The answer of the stones seemed to be yes. He saw pictures of the old red forests with unmistakable birds flying among them, and many other creatures that he did not know. On another stone, many of these were represented lying dead, and a fantastic Hanakra-like figure, presumably symbolizing the cold, was depicted in the sky above them, shooting at them with darts. Creatures still alive were crowding round the winged wavy figure, which he took to be Oyarsa, pictured as a winged flame. On the next stone, Oyasa appeared, followed by many creatures, and apparently making a furrow with some pointed instrument. Another picture showed the furrow being enlarged by Pififeltrigi with digging tools. Sorns were piling the earth up in pinnacles on each side, and Hwasa seemed to be making water channels. Ransom wondered whether this were a mythical account of the making of handramits, or whether they were conceivably artificial in fact. Many of the pictures he could make nothing of. One that particularly puzzled him showed at the bottom a segment of a circle, behind and above which rose three quarters of a disk divided into concentric rings. He thought it was a picture of the sun rising behind a hill. Certainly the segment at the bottom was full of Malachandrian scenes, Oyasa in Meldalorn, Sorns on the mountain edge of the Harandra, and many other things both familiar to him and strange. He turned from it to examine the disk which rose behind it. It was not the sun. The sun was there, unmistakably, at the center of the disk. Round this, the concentric circles revolved. In the first and smallest of these was pictured a little ball, on which rode a winged figure, something like Oyasa, but holding what appeared to be a trumpet. In the next, a similar ball carried another of the flaming figures. This one, instead of even the suggested face, had two bulges, which, after long inspection, he decided were meant to be the udders or breasts of a female mammal. By this time he was quite sure that he was looking at a picture of the solar system. The first ball was Mercury, the second Venus. And what an extraordinary coincidence, thought Ransom, that their mythology, like ours, associates some idea of the female with Venus. The problem would have occupied him longer if a natural curiosity had not drawn his eyes on to the next ball, which must represent the earth. The ball was there, but where a flame-like figure should have been, a deep depression of irregular shape had been cut as if to erase it. Once then, but his speculations faltered and became silent before a series of unknowns. He looked at the bottom circle. Here there was no ball. Instead, the bottom of this circle touched the top of the big segment filled with Malachandrian scenes, so that Malachandra, at this point, touched the solar system and came out of it in perspective towards the spectator. Now that his mind had grasped the design, he was astonished at the vividness of it all. He stood back and drew a deep breath, preparatory to tackling some of the mysteries in which he was engulfed. Malachandra, then, was Mars. The Earth, but at this point, a sound of tapping or hammering, which had been going on for some time without gaining admission to his consciousness, became too insistent to be ignored. Some creature, and certainly not an Eldil, was at work, close to him. A little startled, for he had been deep in thought, he turned round. There was nothing to be seen. He shouted out, idiotically in English, "Who's there?" The tapping instantly stopped, and a remarkable face appeared from behind a neighboring monolith. It was hairless, like a man's or a Sorn's. It was long and pointed like a shrew's, yellow and shabby-looking, and so low in the forehead that, but for the heavy development of the head at the back and behind the ears, like a bagwig, it could not have been that of an intelligent creature. A moment later, the whole of the thing came into view with a startling jump. Ransom guessed that it was a Pififeltrig, and was glad that he had not met one of this third race on his first arrival in Malachandra. It was much more insect-like or reptilian than anything he had yet seen. Its build was distinctly that of a frog, and at first Ransom thought it was resting, frog-like, on its hands. Then he noticed that that part of its forelimbs on which it was supported was really, in human terms, rather an elbow than a hand. It was broad and padded and clearly made to be walked on, but upwards from it, at an angle of about 45 degrees, went the true forearms, thin, strong forearms, ending in enormous, sensitive, many-fingered hands. He realized that for all the manual work from mining to cutting cameos, this creature had the advantage of being able to work with its full strength from a supported elbow. The insect-like effect was due to the speed and jerkiness of its movements, and to the fact that it could swivel its head almost all the way round like a mantis. And it was increased by a kind of dry, rasping, jingling quality in the noise of its moving. It was rather like a grasshopper, rather like one of Arthur Rackham's dwarfs, rather like a frog, and rather like a little old taxidermist whom Ransom knew in London. I come from another world, began Ransom. I know, said the creature in a quick, twittering, rather impatient voice. Come here, behind the stone. This way, Oyasa's orders. Very busy, must begin at once. Stand here. Ransom found himself on the other side of the monolith, staring at a picture which was still in process of completion. The ground was liberally strewn with chips, and the air was full of dust. There, said the creature. Stand still. Don't look at me. Look over there. For a moment, Ransom did not quite understand what was expected of him. Then, as he saw the Pfiffeltrig glancing to and fro at him and at the stone, with the unmistakable glance of artist from model to work, which is the same in all worlds, he realized and almost laughed. He was standing for his portrait. From his position, he could see that the creature was cutting the stone as if it were cheese, and the swiftness of its movements almost baffled his eyes, but he could get no impression of the work done, though he could study the Pfiffeltrig. He saw that the jingling and metallic noise was due to the number of small instruments which it carried about its body. Sometimes, with an exclamation of annoyance, it would throw down the tool it was working with and select one of these, but the majority of those in immediate use it kept in its mouth. He realized also that this was an animal artificially clothed, like himself, in some bright, scaly substance which appeared richly decorated, though coated in dust. It had folds of furry clothing about its throat like a comforter, and its eyes were protected by dark, bulging goggles. Rings and chains of a bright metal, not gold, he thought, adorned its limbs and neck. All the time it was working, it kept up a sort of hissing whisper to itself. And when it was excited, which it usually was, the end of its nose wrinkled like a rabbit's. At last it gave another startling leap, landed about 10 yards away from its work, and said, "Yes, yes, not so good as I hoped. Do better another time. Leave it now. Come and see yourself." Ransom obeyed. He saw a picture of the planets, not now arranged to make a map of the solar system, but advancing in a single procession towards the spectator, and all save one bearing its fiery charioteer. Below lay Malacandra, and there, to his surprise, was a very tolerable picture of the spaceship. Beside it stood three figures, for all of which Ransom had apparently been the model. He recoiled from them in disgust. Even allowing for the strangeness of the subject from a Malacandrian point of view, and for the stylization of their art, still, he thought, the creature might have made a better attempt at the human form than these stock-like dummies, almost as thick as they were tall, and sprouting about the head and neck into something that looked like fungus. He hedged. "I expect it is like me as I look to your people," he said. "It is not how they would draw me in my own world." "No," said the Pfiffeltrig, "I do not mean it to be too like. Too like, and they will not believe it, those who are born after." He added a good deal more, which was difficult to understand. But while he was speaking, it dawned upon Ransom that the odious figures were intended as an idealization of humanity. Conversation languished for a little. To change the subject, Ransom asked a question which had been in his mind for some time. "I cannot understand," he said, "how you and the Sorns and the Hrossa all come to speak the same speech. For your tongues and teeth and throats must be very different." "You are right," said the creature. "Once we all had different speeches, and we still have at home, but everyone has learned the speech of the Hrossa." "Why is that?" said Ransom, still thinking in terms of terrestrial history. "Did the Hrossa once rule the others?" "I do not understand. They are our great speakers and singers. They have more words and better. No one learns the speech of my people, for what we have to say is set in stone and sun's blood and star's milk, and all can see them. No one learns the Sorn's speech, for you can change their knowledge into any words, and it is still the same. You cannot do that with the songs of the Hrossa. Their tongue goes all over Malacandra. I speak it to you because you are a stranger. I would speak it to a Sorn. But we have our old tongues at home. You can see it in the names. The Sorns have big-sounding names like Ogre and Arkol and Belmo and Falme. The Hrossa have furry names like Hno and Hinihi and Hyoi and Tlithnahi. The best poetry, then, comes in the roughest speech?" "Perhaps," said the Pfiffeltrig, "as the best pictures are made in the hardest stone. But my people have names like Kalakaperi and Perakataru and Tafalakeruf. I am called Kanakabaraka." Ransom told it his name. "In our country," said Kanakabaraka, "it is not like this. We are not pinched in the narrow handromit. There are the true forests, the green shadows, the deep mines. It is warm. It does not blaze with light like this, and it is not silent like this. I could put you in a place there in the forest where you could see 100 fires at once and hear 100 hammers. I wish you would come to our country. We do not live in holes like the Sorns, nor in bundles of weed like the Hrossa. I could show you houses with 100 pillars, one of sun's blood and the next of star's milk all the way, and all the world painted on the walls. How do you rule yourselves? Asked Ransom. Those who are digging in the mines, do they like it as much as those who paint the walls? All keep the mines open. It is a work to be shared. But each digs for himself the thing he wants for his work. What else would he do?
It is not so with us.
Then you must make very bent work. How would a maker understand working in sun's blood unless he went into the home of sun's blood himself and knew one kind from another and lived with it for days out of the light of the sky, till it was in his blood and his heart, as if he thought it and ate it and spat it?
With us it lies very deep and hard to get, and those who dig it must spend their whole lives on the skill.
And they love it?
I think not. I do not know. They are kept at it because they are given no food if they stop.
Kanakabaraka wrinkled his nose. Then there is not food in plenty on your world?
I do not know, said Ransom. I have often wished to know the answer to that question, but no one can tell me.
Does no one keep your people at their work, Kanakabaraka?
Our females, said the Pipiple Trig, with a piping noise which was apparently his equivalent for a laugh.
Are your females of more account among you than those of the other Hanahu among them?
Very great. The Sorns make least account of females, and we make most.
Chapter 18. That night Ransom slept in the guest house, which was a real house built by Pfiffeltriggy and richly decorated. His pleasure at finding himself in this respect under more human conditions was qualified by the discomfort which, despite his reason, he could not help feeling in the presence at close quarters of so many Malacandrian creatures. All three species were represented. They seemed to have no uneasy feelings toward each other, though there were some differences of the kind that occurred in a railway carriage on Earth, the Sorns finding the house too hot, and the Pipiple-Triggy finding it too cold. He learned more of Malacandrian humor and of the noises that expressed it in this one night than he had learned during the whole of his life on the strange planet hitherto. Indeed, nearly all Malacandrian conversations in which he had yet taken part had been grave. Apparently the comic spirit arose chiefly from the meeting of the different kinds of Nahu. The jokes of all three were equally incomprehensible to him. He thought he could see differences in kind, as that the Sorns seldom got beyond irony, while the Hrossa were extravagant and fantastic, and the Pfiffeltriggy were sharp and excelled in abuse. But even when he understood all the words, he could not see the points. He went early to bed. It was at the time of early morning, when men on Earth go out to milk the cows, that Ransom was wakened. At first he did not know what had roused him. The chamber in which he lay was silent, empty, and nearly dark. He was preparing himself to sleep again when a high-pitched voice close beside him said, "Oyasa sends for you." He sat up, staring about him. There was no one there, and the voice repeated, "Oyasa sends for you." The confusion of sleep was now clearing in his head, and he recognized that there was an Eldil in the room. He felt no conscious fear, but while he rose obediently and put on such of his clothes as he had laid aside, he found that his heart was beating rather fast. He was thinking less of the invisible creature in the room than of the interview that lay before him. His old terrors of meeting some monster or idol had quite left him. He felt nervous as he remembered feeling on the morning of an examination when he was an undergraduate. More than anything in the world, he would have liked a cup of good tea. The guest house was empty. He went out. The bluish smoke was rising from the lake, and the sky was bright behind the jagged eastern wall of the canyon. It was a few minutes before sunrise. The air was still very cold, the ground weed drenched with dew, and there was something puzzling about the whole scene, which he presently identified with the silence. The Eldil voices in the air had ceased, and so had the shifting network of small lights and shades. Without being told, he knew that it was his business to go up to the crown of the island and the grove. As he approached them, he saw with a certain sinking of heart that the monolithic avenue was full of Malacandrian creatures, and all silent. They were in two lines, one on each side, and all squatting or sitting in the various fashions suitable to their anatomies. He walked on slowly and doubtfully, not daring to stop, and ran the gauntlet of all those inhuman and unblinking eyes. When he had come to the very summit, at the middle of the avenue where the biggest of the stones rose, he stopped. He never could remember afterwards whether an Eldil voice had told him to do so, or whether it was an intuition of his own. He did not sit down, for the earth was too cold and wet, and he was not sure if it would be decorous. He simply stood, motionless, like a man on parade. All the creatures were looking at him, and there was no noise anywhere. He perceived, gradually, that the place was full of Eldila. The lights, or suggestion of lights, which yesterday had been scattered over the island, were now all congregated in this one spot, and were all stationary or very faintly moving. The sun had risen by now, and still no one spoke. As he looked up to see the first pale sunlight upon the monoliths, he became conscious that the air above him was full of a far greater complexity of light than the sunrise could explain, and light of a different kind, Eldil light. The sky, no less than the earth, was full of them. The visible Malachandrians were but the smallest part of the silent consistory which surrounded him. He might, when the time came, be pleading his cause before thousands or before millions. Rank behind rank about him, and rank above rank over his head, the creatures that had never yet seen man and whom man could not see were waiting for his trial to begin. He licked his lips, which were quite dry, and wondered if he would be able to speak when speech was demanded of him. Then it occurred to him that perhaps this waiting and being looked at, was the trial. Perhaps even now he was unconsciously telling them all they wished to know. But afterwards, a long time afterwards, there was a noise of movement. Every visible creature in the grove had risen to its feet and was standing, more hushed than ever, with its head bowed. And Ransom saw, if it could be called seeing, that Oyarsa was coming up between the long lines of sculptured stones. The story is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.